www.dinc.com. Got a lot going on for you this morning. We are going to be bringing you the Up North Report, local news from our region. That's coming up at 7:01. 7:45, it's what we're reading with Tammy Bobrowski. Amor Towles is Tammy's guest today, best-selling author. A collection of short stories and a novella is out from him called Table for Two. He's talking about the recurring theme in the stories and the kind of feedback he gets from readers. Also, coming up at 8:10, we talk about National Astronomy Day. It's coming up on this Saturday, May 3rd, and there's an event going on at the Palucci Space Theater. Dale Kentoff from Range Astronomy Club will join us. And before 9 o'clock, we meet Dr. Hedley Bohm, a fisheries research supervisor with the Minnesota DNR, featured this week with Itasca Water's Practical Water Wisdom webinar series at noon on Thursday, May 1st. Go to itascawaters.org to find more information. News is next. It's 6:01.
I'm Corva Coleman. President Trump says there's a tough road ahead as he tries to broker a peace deal to end Russia's war in Ukraine. NPR's Asma Khalid reports Trump has talked about meeting Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky over the weekend at the Vatican.
Trump said he was disappointed by the recent Russian strikes. He was asked if he trusts Russia's Vladimir Putin. He told reporters he'll let them know in about 2 weeks. The president referred to 2 weeks as a sort of timeline. Trump has been eager to end this war and has spoken about Russia maintaining control over the region it annexed years ago called Crimea. Trump was asked if Zelensky is ready to give up Crimea.
Oh, I think so, yeah. Look, Crimea was 12 years ago. That was President Obama. They gave it up without a shot being fired.
The Ukrainian leader has previously expressed his opposition to giving up that territory. Asma Khalid, NPR News, the White House.
There have been numerous arrests this weekend of migrants whom the U.S. alleges are in the U.S. illegally. Separately, court cases are underway as some migrants and lawyers try to stop their deportations. One case involves a family from New Orleans. The mother does not have legal status, but her 2-year-old daughter is an American citizen. NPR's Joel Rose reports that during a regular immigration check-in, the family was detained and then deported to Honduras.
The judge in this case, who was appointed by President Trump, seems concerned about how this was handled, and he has now set a hearing for next month with the goal of dispelling his, quote, strong suspicion that the government just deported a U.S. citizen with no meaningful process, unquote. According to the ACLU, this is one of 3 U.S. children deported from the U.S., along with mothers without legal status last week.
NPR's Joel Rose reporting. Israeli airstrikes in Gaza have killed at least 70 people in the last 24 hours. That's according to Gaza health officials. The rising death toll comes as food has run out for most people in Gaza. The UN says its food supplies are fully depleted due to Israel's total aid blockade, now in its second month. NPR's Anas Baba has more from Gaza City.
The UN World Food Program says it has no more lentils, beans, or pasta to supply the charity kitchens that half of Gaza's population depends on. 50-year-old Majid Al-Sakani waited more than 2 hours for some cooked rice for her family yesterday. This kitchen is her only source of food. If this hot kitchen shuts down, we will reach total famine, she says. She cannot afford the canned food sold in the markets, where eggs, dairy, and meat are no longer available. Israel says the blockade is meant to pressure Hamas to release hostages and lay down arms. Human rights groups and aid agencies say it's collective punishment and illegal under international law. Anas Baba, NPR News, Gaza City.
This is NPR. Officials in Iran say at least 40 people have been killed after a massive explosion Saturday night at one of Iran's largest shipping ports. More than 800 people are injured. It's unclear what triggered the blast. It also launched a major fire that destroyed surrounding areas. A letter written aboard the Titanic sold for nearly $400,000 at auction over the weekend. That far surpassed expectations. As NPR's Rebecca Rossman reports, the sale reflects the lasting fascination with the famous 1912 shipping disaster.
Auctioneers say the letter written by first-class passenger Colonel Archibald Gracie was especially valuable because of one foretelling line. "It is a fine ship," Gracie wrote the day the Titanic set sail on April 10th, "but I shall await my journey's end before I pass judgment on her." Just days later, the unsinkable Titanic struck an iceberg and sank off of Newfoundland, killing more than 1,500 people. The letter, which has been preserved for over a century, was sold by Henry Aldridge & Son, the same auction house that sold a Titanic violin for more than $1.6 million in 2013. It was purchased by an anonymous bidder. Rebecca Rossman, NPR News.
Media reports in Japan say a college student has now been rescued from Mount Fuji twice in 1 week. The student climbed Japan's tallest peak last Tuesday. He had to be rescued after he lost some equipment. But he went back on Saturday to get his cell phone and other personal items. Then he had to be rescued again after falling ill. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR be the model for high-quality journalism in the 21st century. This is NPR.
In the weeks and months to come, as public radio faces federal funding cuts, KEXE is doubling down on our coverage of what happens here in northern Minnesota. I'm Heidi Holton. We're also working to be more transparent so you know exactly how we are funded. Here's Sarah Bignell, our CEO.
It's just a lot of unknowns, and I've been sitting in on tons of calls and meetings, and all of us had questions, but there's not a lot of answers to them. Sometimes it's hard to tune out the dread that exists. We can do what we can control, right? And so I think getting out the message of support now for us is really important, whether it's you can give us dollars or whether it's you can go and promote the good work that we're doing and spread the word of what we're doing to your friends, neighbors, coworkers, can go a long way as well.
KEXE.org. Read the stories about where you live and help us out. The people of northern Minnesota are our largest single source of funding.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Coming up, we hear a defender of the Wisconsin judge accused of helping a man evade immigration authorities.
First, though, you'll remember that President Trump met with Ukraine's leader, Volodymyr Zelensky, over the weekend. Later, he suggested that Zelensky was ready to give up Crimea, a territory that Russia illegally annexed years ago. Trump has apparently made this part of his administration's peace plan to end the war, but it's a concession that Ukraine has been unwilling to accept. When I spoke earlier with NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte, he suggested a middle way.
There is a difference between acknowledging, stating the fact that part of our country, in case of the Ukrainians, has been captured, in this case by the Russians, and saying now legally they own this. So we really have to make sure that we make that distinction.
Rutte was in Washington last week meeting with President Trump and other top diplomatic and security officials in advance of the annual summit in June for NATO, the world's biggest military alliance. I spoke with him as he was traveling between meetings, and I asked him how they were going, as America seeks to dial back its involvement in many international conflicts.
Yes, we discussed Ukraine. I think we can all be very happy for the fact that President Trump broke the deadlock and started the talks. And obviously, it is the U.S. and U.S. leadership and Trump's leadership which we need here to bring this to a good end, and including the help from Secretary Hegseth, Rubio, and Security Advisor Waltz. So we discussed the state of play on that. I think they're really making progress. The ball is now clearly in Russian's court. So they need to now make proposals, at least react to what is on the table. And we discussed the upcoming NATO summit, which I believe we have every reason to think will be very successful. So much more defense spending, particularly on the European and Canadian side, which is necessary, but also ramping up defense industrial production.
Well, as you just mentioned, in a couple of months, you're going to chair a summit of NATO nations in the Netherlands. You said you believe it will be successful. What does success look like?
For two reasons, I think it will be successful. First of all, because I believe we will decide that the European side of NATO and the Canadian side of NATO will ramp up spending, which is crucial because of the Russian threat, because of the Chinese build-up of its military, but also because it is fair to spend more on that side of NATO because it equalizes with what the US is spending. And rightly, the US has complained, and particularly President Trump has been very clear on this, that he expects the Europeans and Canada to pay more, to step up in terms of their overall defense spending. And that is going to happen. So that will be successful. And then there is an issue around for the whole of NATO, including the US, that we do not produce enough in terms of defense industrial products. Ammunition, Navy ships, tanks, fighter jets, long-range missiles, and air defense systems, what have you. And we will take decisions in June to make sure that we will stay ahead of the Russians and the Chinese, and that is important to keep ourselves safe.
Turning to some specific conflicts, though, there are European leaders, both publicly and privately, have expressed some shock at what seems to be an American tilt toward Russia in these negotiations over the war, which it started in Ukraine, seem to be pressing Ukraine to make concessions, even as by some lights that the U.S. in the current administration doesn't seem to be pressing Russia as hard. Is that your view as well?
It is not. No, I think the U.S. is really trying to, and President Trump's team and he himself really tried to, in an even-handed way, bring this whole process forward. It will mean compromises on all sides. And what we have seen last, the attack on Kyiv, a residential area, people just going about their lives, 12 people killed, because of an indiscriminate attack by the Russians on that part of Kyiv. But also I was in Odessa the other week with President Zelensky, and I've seen the devastation there when attacks take place and these missiles come in this beautiful, beautiful city. This is not a sign of strength by the Russians. If they really are winning this, they would not do this. It is clearly a sign of the weakness on the Russian side.
Ukraine's desire to seek NATO membership is a part of these discussions. Is that officially off the table now, to your understanding, or is that still part of the discussion?
No, there is a clear statement by NATO that there is an irreversible path for Ukraine into NATO, but we always knew that there were different views among allies. NATO is very much involved in building up the Ukrainian armed forces, helping with making sure that all the support for Ukraine, military support for Ukraine, is well coordinated. When it comes to full NATO membership, we never promised Ukraine that we'll be part of a peace deal.
Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth back in February warned that the U.S. is increasingly focused on Asia and its own borders for security. Did you walk away from this meeting feeling confident that the United States is still committed to NATO, even if it sort of reorders its priorities?
100% on both issues. One, the membership of NATO and a total commitment to Article 5. I was 4 weeks ago also visiting President Trump in the White House, and he was very clear on this. Obviously, the U.S. has to take care of more issues than only Europe and the Euro-Atlantic. There's also the Middle East. There's also the Indo-Pacific. So whilst the Europeans are stepping up, spending more, making sure that we can deliver more of the overall capabilities we need to deliver as NATO as a whole, that it's only logical for the U.S. To pivot more towards Asia. But I'm absolutely convinced we will do this in a step-by-step approach. But it's only logical. Everybody understands that.
That is NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte. Mr. Secretary General, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you so much for having me on the program.
Trump administration officials say nobody is above the law, which is why they say the FBI arrested a Wisconsin judge. They accused Milwaukee County Circuit Judge Hannah Dugan of ushering a person without legal status out of a side exit of her courtroom to evade immigration agents who wanted to arrest him. The man was charged with domestic violence at the time. That's why he was in court. Dugan has been released until her next court hearing, but hundreds of protesters have been demonstrating outside the FBI building in Milwaukee, and one of them is on the line, Ryan Clancy, who is a Democratic member of the State Assembly. Mr. Clancy, welcome to the program.
Steve, thanks so much for having me and covering this.
Granting that you're not a witness, you're gathering information from the media or whatever, like the rest of us, do you agree on the basic facts of what seems to have happened here, that there's a Mexican migrant in her court, that ICE agents ask for him, that Judge Dugan gets upset about this and lets him out the side door?
I think some of those facts are in dispute, and I think there's a significant difference here between an administrative warrant, which is what ICE said and admitted that they have in their complaint, which is essentially an internal document, and an actual warrant signed by an actual judge. And I'm very grateful that Judge Dugan recognized the difference and acted accordingly. She just stood up for our community here.
Oh, now this is very interesting, because you could imagine the judge saying, well, someone saying, well, the judge has an obligation to cooperate with the law enforcement authorities, the federal authorities who appear in front of her. But you're saying that you're arguing that they may have had less than full authority to demand full cooperation from the judge?
Absolutely. They did not have a real warrant signed by a real judge. Essentially, an administrative warrant from ICE is a piece of paper that they produce themselves saying they can do what they want. It doesn't have the same power as an actual warrant does. And Judge Dugan, as a judge herself, apparently realized that and did what I hope any of us would do, which is standing up for members of our community who are being targeted by the Trump regime.
Didn't work out for him. I mean, the authorities chased the guy down after he went out the side door, and they arrested him anyway.
They did, and that is it has a really profound and negative chilling effect. Courthouses and courtrooms specifically have been protected spaces, just like operating rooms, classrooms. You don't want law enforcement, you don't want ICE specifically operating without impunity in those areas. And my concern here, and we've already started to see this, is that people who would normally be willingly participating in the justice system are now going to think twice if they think that, you know, showing up either as a defendant or a witness may lead to their own arrest.
Can you tell me, though, what ICE should have done? They have this federal policy to deport people. That is also the law, that people who are not here legally should not be here legally. They are supposed to get this guy. What should they have done? Should they have just left him in the courthouse? Should they have ignored him, tried to find him somewhere else? What should they have done?
Certainly. I mean, I do not think that ICE should be deporting people at all. We have done without ICE for many years. And even prior to that, there's been a longstanding tradition for good reason of not going into those safe, protected spaces. So we can debate whether or not ICE should be deporting people at all. They should not. ICE should be abolished. That said, they absolutely should not be going into courtrooms. That has a chilling effect both on people that are there to participate and also elected and appointed officials like judges who are clearly being targeted by this administration as well.
I want to make sure that I understand what you're telling me. You're not saying ICE should not be deporting people from courts, which is a point of view. You're saying ICE should not be deporting people? Just anybody should come here for any reason and nobody should enforce the law?
That's a larger issue. I mean, certainly we do not have significant legal pathways for folks who want to do the right thing and want to be here and join our American society in the right way. And it is frustrating for people to hear, you know, oh, they should be doing it the right way. There are many, many people who are integrated into our communities, who are part of our communities, who are trying to do the right thing and are trying to get legal status, despite the fact that we make it really difficult at the federal level. We should not be deporting those people either. And to be very clear, ICE should not exist. ICE should be abolished.
Understand your point of view there. Like, getting back to the judge now, are you concerned about where this is going with a judge being arrested given these circumstances?
Absolutely. And this is incredibly unprecedented. A functioning democracy does not arrest sitting judges for doing their job, not for doing anything criminal or illegal. And they certainly don't, you know, handcuff them and then perp walk them in front of handcuffs or in front of cameras. The goal here clearly is a chilling effect. It's to stop people from, you know, doing their jobs and standing up for a community when they are standing up to the Trump regime.
Ryan Clancy is a Wisconsin state representative, member of the Democratic Party, Assembly District 19, which includes part of Milwaukee. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Steve. Appreciate you.
This is NPR News.
It's 6:19. Thanks for tuning in to the Monday Morning Show. I'm Heidi Holton, sitting in for Jennifer Barr. Malachi Coons is my co-host today. Coming up at 9 o'clock, we bring you Headwaters, and Chris Walker is going to be your host today. 1 to 4, it's On the River with Todd and Tiffany, and tonight at 7, it's DJ the DJ. Volunteers make this place run, voices from all over our region. We are so glad to have them, and if you've ever considered hosting a radio show or getting involved somehow, we'd love to have you. You can text volunteer at KAXE.org. We receive support from the Move It Real Estate Group, assisting clients with real estate purchases and sales for over 25 years, not only in Grand Rapids, but across northern Minnesota. Move to what moves you. More at moveitrealestate.com. And thanks to Dragonfly Coffee in Central Square Mall in Grand Rapids, a scratch bakery and espresso bubble tea and more, empowering inclusion and community through employment. Special order pricing and more at drinkdragonfly.com. Coming up at 6:30, we bring you National Native News and Laura Erickson speaking for the birds. A lot going on this morning. Hope you had a good weekend. Let us know, do you have a favorite poem? Text us 218-326-1234. That's our question of the week. More news is next from Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Workday. Workday is an AI platform for forward thinkers, dedicated to transforming the way business leaders manage people and money today so they can transform tomorrow. Workday, moving business forever forward. From the Lemelson Foundation, working to harness the power of invention and innovation to accelerate climate action and improve lives around the world. Learn more at lemelson.org. From Viking, dedicated to creating travel experiences for the thinking person, with programs designed for cultural enrichment on board and on shore. Learn more at viking.com. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. The federal government has canceled about $11 billion worth of university research funding and is threatening to cut more. NPR's Alyssa Nadworny reports that when the federal government stops funding research, there's really no one else to take on those costs.
In the first 3 months of Donald Trump's presidency, dozens of colleges and universities had their federal research grants frozen. Some funds were canceled because of the shuttering of federal departments like USAID and the U.S. Department of Education. Others were halted in response to alleged anti-Semitism on campus. Cancer research, diabetes, research in new wearable technology, farming solutions, early childhood development, and domestic violence. Research across nearly every discipline and subject.
The government-university-industry partnership for R&D built the American economy in the 20th century.
Shailen Jotishi is the managing director of the Future of Work and Innovation Economy Initiative at New America, a left-leaning think tank. After World War II, he says the federal government entrusted and deeply invested in universities to conduct research and development.
Everything from the iPhone to GPS technology to fortified vitamin D has had its roots in federally funded research.
In 2021, the federal government gave colleges and universities about $180 billion across dozens of federal agencies, according to the Government Accountability Office, a government watchdog.
American research universities have been the envy of the world for a reason. China and other competitors of the United States are borrowing from the American playbook for innovation.
Jotishi says that the biggest worry is that if the government gets out of this business, there won't be anyone to step in.
Industry cannot and will not pick up the mantle of the public sector in supporting the R&D enterprise.
Sabrina Howell, a finance professor at NYU's business school, studies innovation and university research.
We would not have iPhones if universities like MIT that are federally government funded hadn't worked on lasers.
That laser technology wasn't just used on the iPhone. It helped create semiconductors that essentially power everything we use all day long.
No private company would take on their own, both because it's really expensive. It's not obvious what the commercial application is for all the work that you're doing. And so only government can fund that kind of work.
While the Trump administration talks about handing this work off to the private sector, Howell says it's just too expensive to fund that without a clear return on investment. Her research shows that's because industry has a different motivation on outputs. But there are experts who think changes could be made to this partnership.
It's time for someone to shake things up a bit.
Richard Vedder is a senior fellow at the Independent Institute, a libertarian think tank. He's written about scaling back government funding for research overhead and administration. And while he says Trump's arbitrary cuts aren't what he had in mind, it's definitely sending an important message to colleges.
It's not perhaps the ideal way to change things. It may be a disruptive way to change things. But on the whole, the attempt to reevaluate research grant money is a valid one.
He says maybe now that the public sees the high price tag of federally funded research, there will be a way to make changes or disruptions without abruptly halting essential and life-saving research. Alyssa Nadworny, NPR News.
A new batch of musicians is heading to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, including a major 80s pop star, a groundbreaking Southern rap duo, and a 60s dance icon who spent years lobbying for his own induction. NPR's Isabella Gomez Sarmiento has the rundown.
There are seven performers who will join the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame this year. They joined the 255 artists who are already in the hall, ranging from rock and roll founders like Chuck Berry and Elvis Presley through 21st century artists like Missy Elliott. In recent years, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame has expanded the definition of its namesake genre, but it's still letting in straight-ahead rock acts like the classic rockers Bad Company. I can't get enough of your love. Bad Company has been eligible since 1999, but was nominated for the first time this year. Grunge pioneers Soundgarden are also on the list. So is the legendary Southern rap duo, Outkast. Made up of Big Boi and Andre 3000, Outkast put Atlanta on hip-hop's map with albums like AT Aliens, Stankonia, and Speakerbox, The Love Below. This year, they'll be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. So will the rainbow-haired pop star Cyndi Lauper, who rose to stardom on 80s dance floors and on MTV with hits like this one. If you look, you can look, and you will find me. Time after time. Also getting inducted is the late English singer Joe Cocker. Lend me your ears and I'll sing you a song. Cocker became a star in the U.S. with this raspy rendition of the Beatles song With a Little Help from My Friends at Woodstock in 1969. But he went on to release more than 40 albums, spawning hits like Feeling All Right and You Are So Beautiful. Artists are eligible for the Rock Hall 25 years after their first commercial release. And the youngest, by that criteria, is the White Stripes. The guitar, drums, and vocal duo were at the forefront of the garage rock revival of the early 2000s. The artist who waited the longest for his nomination is Chubby Checker. He danced his way to the very top of the Billboard Hot 100 with this cover of The Twist in 1960. Come on, baby. In 2001, Chubby Checker took out a full-page ad in Billboard magazine saying he felt underappreciated for his contributions to rock and roll. He adamantly requested his own induction into the Rock Hall, writing, quote, "I want my flowers while I'm alive. I can't smell them when I'm dead." It's been more than two decades, but the bouquet is finally on its way. Each year, in addition to the inductees named by the hall's voters, a few musicians are also included as musical influences. This year's honored artists are the groundbreaking female rap group Salt-N-Pepa and the 70s and 80s rock songwriter Warren Zevon. The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction ceremony will take place on November 8th in Los Angeles. Isabella Gomez Sarmiento, NPR News.
It's NPR News.
After college, deaf students are less likely to find jobs in the sciences, healthcare, or teaching, and government grants that aim to change that were just ended by the Trump administration.
I definitely feel like if things had been different, I wouldn't be feeling so lost and unsure about my future.
I'm Ari Shapiro, the uncertainty ahead for students on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
You can tune in for All Things Considered coming up this afternoon at 4 o'clock with your local host, Andrew DeZingle. It's 6:29. I'm Heidi Holton. Thanks for tuning in to the Monday Morning Show. I'm sitting in for Jennifer Barr. Malachi Coons will be my co-host today. And then coming up at 9 o'clock, we've got Headwaters. Your host today is Chris Walker. Looking at the weather, we are seeing that there thunderstorms are likely and rainfall could be heavy at times. There could be a few storms that could be severe. We're looking at temperatures in the mid to upper 50s and low 70s in the Brainerd Lakes region. Breezy southeast winds 10 to 25. Lows overnight tonight 28 to 33. Tomorrow, Tuesday, mostly cloudy, then clearing with highs in the low to mid 50s. And northwest winds 10 to 15, gusting up to 25. Evening lows tomorrow, 30 to 36. And by Wednesday, looking mostly sunny with highs in the mid to upper 60s. This is the last week of April, and we are celebrating April as Poetry Month. We want to know if you have a favorite. Maybe there was a poem you had to memorize in school. Do you still remember it? You can text 218-326-1234. Lots of things going on, including this week we have an event in Bemidji. It is the Get Downtown with KBXE. It's at the Loft in downtown Bemidji this Thursday with Chastity Brown and Dilly Dally Alley. The doors open at 5. Music starts at 6. The space is limited. It's free and open to everyone. All the attendees will be entered into a raffle with prizes like tickets to Grand Rapids Riverfest. There'll be an after party at Keg and Cork with the staff, made possible with support from the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund of Minnesota. Up next, we'll have National Native News. Today, we are learning about a bill that would provide temporary state funding so local officials in Montana can hash out a long-term plan for who pays for law enforcement services on the Flathead Reservation. Stay tuned for that story. We've also got more news coming up from National Public Radio and the latest installment of local news, the Up North Report.
This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. A long fight over who pays for law enforcement services on the Flathead Reservation may be coming to an end. Montana Public Radio's Aaron Bolton reports a bill would provide temporary state funding so local officials can hash out a long-term plan.
For decades, Lake County has arrested and prosecuted tribal members on the Flathead Reservation under an agreement known as Public Law 280. But the county in recent years has said it can't afford the work and asked that the state chip in. Lawmakers did give the county funding last legislative session, but Governor Gene Forte vetoed the bill, saying the state isn't financially responsible. This session, discussions between the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes, Gene Forte's office, and county officials resulted in new legislation that would give the county $6 million over the next 2 years. Lake County Commissioner Gail Decker says the bill requires the tribes and the county to create a plan for law enforcement that doesn't involve state resources.
We think we can come up with an MOU that's going to work, and it'll help us transition into the next phase of Public Law 280.
The bill has passed both chambers and is nearing Gian Forte's desk. In Columbia Falls, I'm Aaron Bolton.
I did what I had to do.
As season 3 of AMC's detective series Dark Winds winds down this coming Sunday, executive producer and director Chris Eyre reflects on the evolution of Native Americans in popular culture. Eyre's breakthrough film was 1998 Smoke Signals, a feature-length movie that showed the complexity and humor of Native people after decades of stereotypes. I asked Eyre if he ever saw the success of Native-produced and written series like Dark Winds and others on the horizon 27 years ago.
Well, before
I think Reservation Dogs in Rutherford Falls, I was getting somewhat concerned that smoke signals was just going to be a blip on the radar of yesteryear. But I think smoke signals is part of the continuum of progress with Native people in front of the camera and behind the camera.
Air has directed several episodes of Dark Winds, including the season 3 premiere. They had a surprise cameo with Robert Redford and George R.R. Martin, who are also executive producers. Air says he loves all the characters in this intriguing and often mystical storyline, including the dynamic between Joe and Emily Porn. He says compelling and humanizing treatment of Native people in film and television is a sign that this kind of smart storytelling has arrived.
And I don't think it's going to stop. I think now we've gotten to a place that the door is not going to close again. I think there's too many people, Native and non-Native, but Native people that are leading the charge as writers and directors and performers and musicians and artists and executives that have pushed this door open. And I don't think the door is going to ever close again.
Season 3 of Dark Winds is wrapping up with the 8th and final episode, but even before the first episode dropped, news came out that Season 4 was greenlit. Air says he's blessed to be part of this series.
I just want to say, tune in for Season 4. I'm as excited as anybody to know what happens, and I'm an insider, so we're all working really hard right now to make Season 4 great, like Season 3, and I'm excited to see what happens.
Dark Winds airs Sunday nights on AMC. It's based on Tony Hillerman's novels and stars Zahn McLarnon, Kiowa Gordon, and Jessica Matson. This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull.
National Native News, you hear it here on KAXC. It's made possible in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Good morning. Hope you're having a good Monday morning. We are looking at a day of possible rain. Some sources here are saying 100% chance of rain, and we may have some thunderstorms moving in. Some storms could be severe and produce heavy rainfall and damaging winds. Highs in the mid to upper 50s, but in the Brainerd Lakes area, more like 70s. Breezy southeast winds 10 to 25 with lows overnight 28 to 33 degrees. And mostly cloudy tomorrow, then it'll be clearing and temperatures tomorrow in the low to mid 50s. Northwest winds again up to 25 miles an hour and evening lows 30 to 36 degrees. If you missed Friday, we announced the 2025 Grand Rapids River Fest. It is coming up on September 6th. The tickets are going to go on sale this week on Friday, May 2nd. If you are a member of KEXC, you get a $10 discount on each ticket during this early bird sale. If you have questions about your membership, you can email Heather at kaxc.org. Here's how this will go. We're featuring headliner Courtney Barnett, then Margo Price, then Jeremy Albino, and Alan Sparhawk. Find more information on the bands and Spotify playlists at GrandRapidsRiverFest.com. We received support this morning from North Homes Children and Family Services, providing compassionate mental health services to children and families in home, school, and in the community. More information at NorthHomes.org. And we'd like to thank the Judy Garland Museum, located on Highway 169 in Grand Rapids. Featuring Judy Garland's 1920s childhood home and a gallery of Judy and Wizard of Oz memorabilia, including the original carriage from the film. Visitor information is available at judygarlandmuseum.com. Coming up, we've got more news from National Public Radio. We're getting an update from Texas, where health officials are concerned about more children being exposed to measles. But first, new music from camp.
down, it's okay.
Perry from Brainerd is a regular contributor to the KAXE Morning Show. She talks about birds and other wildlife. We asked her why she supports this station.
So, and now the most recent thing is the newsroom. And I love the news reports. You're not hearing that anywhere else. You're not hearing about what county boards are doing and local governments. This is the place. This is where you're going to hear about it. And the music was wonderful. You know, and you had your volunteer hosts. And again, local people often. I want to support it. I want to support something. And then, of course, when I was listening, I was going, where else do you hear about bud break and plants and birds and forestry and all the things that, you know, were northern Minnesota?
You can become a member like Pam Perry. Give now at KAXE.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Next, we meet some of the people affected by a number in the news.
That number is 884. That is the number of confirmed cases of measles in the United States this year, according to the Centers for Disease Control. So it's April, and we've already tripled the number of cases from last year. Years ago, officials thought measles had been eradicated. Officials also say vaccine hesitancy is a factor in the resurgence.
Measles is in 30 U.S. states now, and we have a view of it this morning in one hard-hit county in Texas. Brad Burt with member station KTTZ went there. Hi there, Brad.
Hey, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Glad you're with us. Where'd you go?
So I was in Gaines County last week, where a little less than half of all the measles cases in the country have been confirmed, 393 to be exact. What I saw was children playing out at a park in Seminole there, people coming in and out of a coffee shop on Main Street. But meanwhile, the MMR vaccine clinic set up by the South Plains Health District was empty. Zach Holbrooks, director for the district, says vaccine hesitancy has remained an obstacle to ending that outbreak.
It's a lot of groups that are hesitant. So all we can do is provide the venue for people to either get tested, screened, or get the vaccine.
At the beginning of the year, the vaccination rate for this county was 82%. Now, the Centers for Disease Control says at least 95% vaccination rate is needed to prevent outbreaks.
I appreciate that perspective. The vast majority of people in this vaccine-hesitant county are actually not vaccine-hesitant. They've taken the vaccine, but some are not, and that leads to this problem. So what's being done?
Well, local health authorities set up a pop-up clinic in a building where livestock shows are normally held, and billboards and local TV ads encourage people to get vaccinated. There's messaging in English, Spanish, and actually Low German for the local Mennonite community. And yet many here still don't trust vaccines. Pediatrician Dr. Anna Montanez says some parents have chosen to forgo the vaccine for other unproven remedies like vitamin A.
That is our biggest nemesis, right, is misinformation, at least from, you know, healthcare perspective. I struggle with that every single day with almost every patient that I see.
Now, Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. previously endorsed vitamin A as a treatment for measles. He has since stepped back from that and is recommended the best treatment as the MMR vaccine.
So you have a longtime vaccine skeptic, maybe the top vaccine skeptic in the country, saying the vaccine is good in this case, but I guess that comes too late for some people. So how has this affected especially children?
Yeah, most of the cases in Texas are children. The two deaths so far in West Texas were children. And you have to ask why that would be. Well, here's an intriguing number. About 18% of students in public schools in this county claim conscientious exemption to required vaccines, and that's provided by state law. Dr. Montanez insists that vaccination is the best prevention, but she says an ounce of protection is worth way more than a pound of cure. But she also says when she engages skeptics and answers their questions about alternative remedies like vitamin A, many have become more open to safer decisions. Now, when I was in Seminole, families continued to go about their daily lives. Schools were open, businesses were open, and the virus continues to spread.
Brad Burt with KTTZ in Lubbock, Texas. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
This is NPR News.
It's Morning Edition here on People Powered KEXE. I'm Heidi Holton. Good morning to you on this Monday. We open up our question of the week on Mondays. I'm sitting in for Jennifer Barr today. And the question is, do you have a favorite poem? Did you have to memorize a poem in school? Do you still remember it? Love to hear from you this morning. You can text in 218-326-1234. Coming up, we've got news out of Canada where 11 people were killed and more than two dozen injured after a man drove an SUV into a crowd of people at a Filipino festival in Vancouver, British Columbia. Also more on the elections today. Canadians are going to the polls. Tomorrow is a special election throughout our region for Senate District 6. There is an election guide now available. Our news team has asked the candidates about things like climate and childcare, housing, and more. You can find the candidate responses and voting information at KEXE.org. An hour from now, it is what we're reading with our staff librarian, Tammy Bobrowski. Amor Towles is her guest today. He is a New York Times bestselling author, a gentleman in Moscow, and many more. He's got a new book out. It's a collection of stories called Table for Two. That conversation coming up in about an hour. We are also learning about National Astronomy Day this Saturday from the Range Astronomy Club coming up at 8:10 this morning, and learning about Fisher's Research Supervisor. We're learning about this month's topic, which is this Thursday. The Itasca Waters Nonprofit Group hosts monthly online meetings that you can be a part of or lectures. The webinar is this Thursday. You can find out more and sign up at itascawaters.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. We're going to spend a few minutes this morning on news from Canada, including the national election happening today. But first, a man in Vancouver has been charged with 8 counts of murder after he drove an SUV into a crowd at a Filipino cultural festival on Saturday night. At least 11 people were killed. Police say it was not a terrorist attack, but there are still plenty of questions about how and why it happened. NPR's Becky Sullivan has this report.
It had been a beautiful spring Saturday afternoon in Vancouver for the city's new annual Lapu-Lapu Day Festival. It was a Filipino street party tied to a holiday in the Philippines that celebrates a historic indigenous victory over Spanish troops back in the 1500s. Saturday's block party in Vancouver had dozens of food trucks and vendors, and thousands of people were in attendance. But by sundown, the scene had turned into a nightmare. Around 8:15 p.m., a man driving a black SUV sped into a crowd of hundreds milling between two rows of food trucks and vendor stalls. Videos circulating on social media showed the chaotic aftermath, with bodies laying on the pavement and bystanders caring for the wounded. Chris Pongilinan was working one of the booths and described what he saw in an interview with the CBC.
It was like seeing a bowling ball hit all the bowling pins and all the pins go flying up in the air. It looked like we were in a war zone.
In addition to the dead, dozens were injured.
This is the darkest day in our city's history.
This is Vancouver's acting police chief Steve Rye speaking to reporters Sunday. The victims' ages ranged from 5 to 65 years old, he said.
There are many unanswered questions about why this horrific crime happened, the motive of the person who did it, and whether anything could have been done to prevent it.
Police identified the driver as 30-year-old Vancouver resident Kai G. Adam Lowe. He was detained by bystanders at the scene, then taken into police custody. City officials, including Mayor Ken Sim, said Sunday they were still trying to figure out the motive.
Evidence points to this not being an act of terrorism. The individual in question has a significant history of mental health issues. He is known to police for a multitude of mental health interactions.
Authorities did not elaborate on the man's previous interactions with police, except to say they were, quote, significant. Becky Sullivan, NPR News.
Canadians vote today in an election to decide the country's next prime minister. Much of the campaigning has been about which candidate can best handle President Trump. NPR International Affairs correspondent Jackie Northam reports from Nova Scotia.
At a recent political rally in the northern Canadian city of Edmonton, thousands of supporters gave a rousing welcome to Pierre Poilievre, leader of the Conservative political party and one of the main candidates in the country's upcoming election. Edmonton is the capital of Alberta, a western prairie province considered to be the Texas of Canada, big on oil and gas and cattle. Here, Poilievre's stand against immigration, big government, and the ruling Liberal Party resonated with supporters like Tegan Reimer.
I'm attending the Pierre rally because I'm sick of the Liberal government for the past 9 years and I want some change.
For months, Poilievre's poll numbers were cresting, while Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's numbers were rock bottom. Poilievre was almost guaranteed a landslide victory in Canada's next election. Almost.
Within an instant, events changed.
David Coletto is founder and CEO of Abacus Data, a Canadian polling firm. He says in January, things started to unravel for Poilievre.
The primary villain was Justin Trudeau. He left. A new villain emerged, bigger, more scary, external to the country in Donald Trump.
Shortly after his inauguration, President Trump started targeting Canada, imposing steep tariffs and threatening its sovereignty.
I think Canada is going to be a very serious contender to be our 51st state.
Trump's taunts and threats outraged many Canadians and led to a rise in nationalism. But Trump's comments also threw a bright spotlight on Poilievre.
Many people in Canada have associated a lot of the language, a lot of the terminology, speaking points that Pierre Poilievre uses to exactly what Donald Trump has been saying.
Robert Hewish is a social science professor at Dalhousie University in Halifax.
Canada first, migration is a bad thing, stronger borders, budget cuts, all the stuff that you would hear Trump sort of doing, Poilievre has really adapted.
And that association with Trump has hurt Poilievre badly. In January, Poilievre and his Conservative Party were up in the polls, at one point 27 points ahead. But in a stunning turnaround, the Liberals have roared back, and most polls show they're now slightly ahead of the Conservatives. Coletto says Poilievre's setback has benefited Trudeau's successor, Prime Minister Mark Carney.
Mark Carney, the new Liberal leader and Prime Minister, emerged at a moment where I think more and more Canadians were looking for somebody with his experience, with his demeanor, with his approach to politics.
Carney has a financial background on Wall Street, as governor of the Bank of England during the turmoil of Brexit, and as head of the Bank of Canada. But Poilievre says Carney has the same troubled policies as Trudeau. That came up during the election debates, like this one broadcast on global television.
And we're doing a pretty good impersonation of him with the same policies tonight.
Very different.
Carney seems to have a better relationship with Trump than Trudeau did. And his popularity has helped Liberal candidates across Canada. I met up with Jessica Fancy Landry at a cozy cafe in Lunenburg. She's a first-time candidate running as a Liberal in a small district here in the Maritime Province of Nova Scotia.
People know that this is a historic election. I don't think that there's ever been an election that means more to Canada.
Fancy Landry says voters pepper her with questions about the impact of Trump and his policies on Canada.
Definitely tariffs have been discussed and questioned, and a lot of it is bewilderment.
Jared Wesley, a political scientist at the University of Alberta in Edmonton, says the upcoming Canadian election needs to be about more than just Trump and his policies.
We aren't talking about social policy issues a heck of a lot, and we aren't talking about the environment. Those have been crowded out.
But with a powerful neighbor targeting the country, Canadian voters can't ignore the impact of Trump on the election. Jackie Northam, NPR News, Lunenburg, Nova Scotia.
This afternoon on All Things Considered, what do autistic people think about the way Robert F. Kennedy Jr. describes them? There is a very wide range of autistic people. About a quarter are profoundly affected, and we will hear the leader of the National Council on Severe Autism. Tell your smart speaker to play your local station by name, or listen to the NPR app, or turn on the radio. This is NPR News.
You can hear the story coming up on All Things Considered 4 o'clock today on People-Powered KAXC. It's 6:56. I'm Heidi Holton.
I'm Malachi Coons.
Morning, Malachi.
Good morning, Heidi. As I was driving in, I heard that the question of the week is about poems. Did you have a favorite poem? I didn't hear if you already mentioned it earlier.
I haven't yet. And I've asked some folks, too. What I do have is one that we had to memorize. Did you ever have to memorize in school?
I did. Thanks to Mr. Nelson, who I remember this positively.
Okay.
But we memorized a few throughout the year. I believe they were, How Do I Love Thee? Let Me Count the Ways. Stopping by Woods on Snowy Evening, and maybe one other one. And the one that stuck with me the most is Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening by Robert Frost.
Can you just roll out some of it, or is it still committed
to memory?
Let's
see. Whose woods these are, I think I know. His house is in the village, though. He will not see me stopping here to watch his woods fill up with snow.
There we go.
And I think I remember most of it, but there was a line at the end that always tripped me up. And How Do I Love You? Let Me Count the Ways. I never really got that full one.
Okay.
I didn't understand the topic. No, that's not what I meant.
Right.
It was more loquacious, more verbose than...
Nice. That, good words there.
That Robert Frost, kind of earnest, out in the woods, ponderings.
We haven't heard from anybody yet. We'd love to hear from you, or just got a text in, a poem. I'll take a look at this. I said it might be good for John Latimer.
Okay.
One of the ones I had to... remember or memorize was in high school, Andre Lamour's humanities class. We had to memorize so many things. was Emily Dickinson. I never understood, why do we have to memorize this one? It's called Because I Could Not Stop for Death, It Kindly Stopped for Me. The carriage held but just ourselves in immortality.
Ooh.
We slowly drove, we knew no haste, as I had put away my labor and my leisure too for his civility.
I like that, but you don't know why it was picked.
No, it just seemed dark, and then I looked at it. There were parts that were hard for me to remember, so I had to print it out. I wasn't looking at paper when I said that part, though, right?
Impressive.
But Yeah, sometimes they had you memorize them. I do like, there's a lot of my favorite poets of mine, especially from Minnesota. For so many years, we did our poetry program, The Beat. So we got to hear so many Minnesota poets, thanks to Guido, Steve Downing, and we do still have connections to The Beat on our website, kaxc.org. But love Louis Jenkins and Joyce Sutphin and great poets like that. And of course, Mary Oliver. You can't beat Mary Oliver.
I was going to say, later in life, Mary Oliver has become my favorite, but I have not yet memorized any of them. We did hear from Laura, who says Annabelle Lee by Edgar Allan Poe. Is a favorite, I'm guessing. Yeah. Or maybe one that was had to memorize in school.
Right. And Mary, good morning to you. She's wishing you and I happy morning. And she says, love, love, love the rain. I did hear some rain start to come down. How was it when you...
It was not raining when I came down, but, okay, you know, it looked like it had rained. Okay. And, you know, according to the weather, mm-hmm, there is